Good evening. I'm Marissa Levine, Director of Inforum, an innovation lab at the Commonwealth Club, and welcome to tonight's program, Big Data and You, with Chief Data Scientist DJ Patil, in conversation with Liza Dwoskin of The Washington Post. We are thrilled to have DJ here tonight and looking forward to a truly excellent program. Now, I have a favor. Before we get started, introduce yourself to the person next to you. My favorite thing, other than bringing interesting people on stage, is introducing other interesting people to each other. So take a moment and say hi. I've unleashed a beast here. Too many new friends. So great to see new faces. Great to have helped make some new friends. Please bring your new friends back to another program. We hope to have you back here again and again, preferably with one of your new friends. We host hundreds of programs a year at the Commonwealth Club, and you saw some of our favorites in our video just now. Now, as a nonprofit, that requires the support of our attendees, our members, our volunteers, our donors, and more. So we'd love to get you more involved with us. If you're interested in that, please see a member of our staff on our way out. We're even building a new home on the Embarcadero and moving in early 2017. So get on board and help us housewarm. Now, coming up at Inforum, May 9th, we have Charles Duhigg on his new book, Smarter, Faster, Better, and it is sold out. But there's a chance to win tickets, so check our website or tweet Smarter with Inforum at us for a chance to win. May 17th, we'll have a sustainable fashion panel supported by Levi. May 26th, Jessica Herron, the CEO of Stella & Dot. We've got a couple exciting programs coming up in June, so stay tuned for announcements on those. And at the end of June, author Emma Klein on her new book, and you can get tickets at commonwealthclub.org. Now, we are guilty of live tweeting our events, so please don't make us feel guilty alone. You can mention Inforum SF, DJ44, and Liza Dwoskin if you tweet tonight, and please use the hashtag Inforum SF. However, don't disturb your neighbors, turn your screens down, ringers off, you know the drill. And now, it is my absolute pleasure to welcome to the stage U.S. Chief Data Scientist DJ Patil and moderator Liza Dwoskin.
So thank you. Thanks for the intro, and welcome to tonight's program. DJ, I'm very excited to be talking about big data with you again, a topic I was steeped in for years at the Wall Street Journal, but definitely not as long as you've been steeped in it. I think this guy, he did his PhD about big data and data mining, weather data, and from the National Oceanic Administration forecasting data. So let's dive in. I think the last time that we talked was a year ago, and you were just starting this role as the first chief data scientist of the United States. So why does the president want a data scientist? Why does the president need one?
I just want to say, how amazing is it that we live in an age where we can fill a theater to talk about data?
Yeah, definitely. Like,
it's just awesome. I think it's just awesome. So why does the president need a chief data scientist? And why even create that role? I think there's something very unique about this president. And just think about it for a second, that we have a president who is a congressional law scholar, a professor of congressional law, and he is the person at the government who is saying, we really need to think about data and technology as a cornerstone strategic idea to revolutionize how do we push the country forward. And that whole seminal component of that he's focused on is, I think, what has really laid the framework and the foundation for somebody to come in and say, hey, here's how we're going to channel and harness all of this into a cohesive strategy and effort. And what he's done is saying, well, not only you, but your team are the person I hold accountable for doing this, but also
small responsibility, but also
a rallying to enable us to do that in the same way that he created a chief technical officer, Megan Smith, and before that, Todd Park, but also now a chief digital officer to think about the new ways we're using digital media to communicate with American citizens, Jason Goldman. He's really using the power of titles and roles to focus the government into doing new and novel things that it might have been traditionally, it's going to get,
but it would take a lot longer than we would like.
And obviously, Megan Smith came from Google. You came from the elegant Relate IQ. Your former colleagues are now at Salesforce. What do you think it says about the relationship between Washington and Silicon Valley?
The first part that is most important for me is there's a myth going around that Silicon Valley is here that's necessary to save the government. And I can't emphasize enough how false that narrative is. For me personally, I got my start as an academic, and then I got to go into the Department of Defense, where I got taught some of the most valuable lessons. We're here in a theater that outside, as you walk around, it's showing all the incredible things of people who have served, particularly in the Marines. And being able to work side by side with those in the armed forces, there is nothing greater than working with them to understand the notion of pure altruistic mission. And those that put their lives on the lines for our national security. And that ability to understand what mission is and then come back out into Silicon Valley where people are working now and saying, oh, I have to have mission, that's one of the things that I think enabled me to make the transition into Silicon Valley so effectively. What I think we're seeing now is a model that existed much earlier but we've forgotten about. A model in the government that it was far more porous, that people used to go back and forth between government and industry and academia. And what's happening is this president has rekindled that through not only through these roles, but through organizations like the U.S. Digital Service that brings technologists in to work on a particular problem, or 18F, or the Presidential Innovation Fellows. He's created all these cool mechanisms to allow this transferability to happen.
Yeah, and to try to harness the clout of Silicon Valley, both in the world and in the country.
But Silicon Valley, Silicon Beach, Silicon Prairie.
Silicon,
like all those different things. It's harnessing technologists writ large to come in. Mm-hmm. We just see the stories of us because I think it's some of the easy ones to tell.
Yeah. So, the thing I remember when I talked to you a year ago and I went to visit you in the White House is that you were tooling around the White House on your skateboard. And I was doing an interview for the Wall Street Journal and you were on your skateboard. And of course I was thinking, what a different place to work this is than the tech world. So yeah. How's that been for you?
Yeah. I own a suit.
your first one? Is that your first suit?
It's first in a long time. I admit that, one of the saving graces of going to D.C. is that there are YouTube videos on how to tie a tie fast. And so that's a lifesaver. But it's a very, people ask, what is the White House like? Mm-hmm. The White House and this White House under this president in particular is the word I would use to describe it is compassionate. It's an extraordinarily team-minded one. We don't have scandals. We don't have leaks. And I think the reason why that is the case is, within the team.
I work for a newspaper
others,
that knows about
there's some
that.
Other ones that I'm sure we'll get to.
You have leaks.
but it's an extraordinarily tight-knit family. And it's a family that really comes together in a way that feels very similar to early-stage companies.
Like a startup?
Like a startup. And it's not that big of a place. It's a small place. You just come around. Everybody's looking out for each other, and it's a really powerful, gratifying feeling. And as some of you may know, on the downside, we lost tragically one of our remarkable colleagues, Jake Brewer, last year in a tragic bicycle accident where he was raising money for cancer. And you really get to see how a building responds to not only for his family. He left a daughter on the way and one a two-year-old daughter. But he left a mission. He left a mission unfinished. And it was a mission that he personally believed in of civic engagement and really focusing on how do we engage technologists to really champion civic mindfulness and how do we transform the conversation we have. And I can't tell you how awesome it is to go around the building and see all different parts of that building pick up components of that mission to carry the water forward. And that's the kind of White House it is. And I think that stems fundamentally from this president.
That's very interesting. Well, I want to dive into the details. I know we don't want this to be too wonky of a conversation, mm-hmm. but everyone is here to listen to the U.S. chief data scientist, so it's got to get wonky. So tell me, yeah, what have you been doing as the chief data scientist? What's the job?
Well, after we got the tie done,
we got the tie done. You brought your skateboard. Right? You moved to Washington. Skateboard.
The number one thing that we've been focused on is first, you've got to establish mission. And the mission of the U.S. Chief Data Scientist, simply put, is to responsibly unleash the power of data to benefit all Americans. And the two things that are critically important that I want you to take away when we're done tonight is to know that there's, number one, the word responsibly in that mission, and that is chosen with intention. Because what you can do with data offers incredible promise, but also significant challenges. And we just released a major White House report today talking about them, and hopefully we'll talk a little bit about that.
Sure.
The other part is all Americans. We're here in Silicon Valley. Remarkable, amazing things are happening every day in technology people build. I would assert, and the thing I've taken away from this job, is that we should think of a technology as neither radical nor revolutionary unless it benefits every single person in this country and then the world. Every single person. And we have technologies.
It's a big mission.
That's a big mission. But that is what the government does. And when you are engaged in that mission, like think about some of our technologies. The mobile phone. It benefits a large percentage of the population, but not everybody. Internet, the same way. There are some that benefit every single person. Healthcare. How do we use technology to think about the dynamics that we're having of the conversation on policing at the national level?
Yeah, so we were talking the other day, and you told me that you went to a jail in Oakland. Mm-hmm. What were you doing there?
So visiting a jail. I'd never been to a jail. and it's one of those things, like when you go visit a jail, you know, one of the things about this role is every person in this country matters and knowing how what's important to them, what their issues are. And so I had the fortunate of going with Deputy Chief Paul Figueroa to the Oakland jails and sit down with inmates. So what do you do when you have a set of inmates? What do you talk about? And the question that I am very fortunate to get to ask is I get to ask, if the president was here, what would you want him to know? The inmates have a remarkable set of things if you really listen to them. Number one, they don't want to be there. They know that. They don't want to get in a fight. So you know what the first thing they ask is? Can we have some music? Can we have some yoga? Literally. They want therapy. They want
services.
Anger management. They want educational opportunities. They don't want a path out of it. But you know what else they want? They know that they have some loved one on the other outside. That loved one oftentimes is taking care of a child. Child care. Because now that other partner has to figure out how to take care of that. And does it create a downward spiral for a child? They want to know about healthcare opportunities.
So how does all of that relate to data and you as a JAFE data scientist?
So one of the things that we're focused on is thinking about what does it mean around our population in jails. Right now, every year, we have 11.4 million people that go through 3,100 jails. So just think about those numbers for a second. 11.4 million, 3,100 jails. Like that is, something's not, that's wrong on every dimension. It gets worse though. How often do they stay there? How long do they stay there? On average, 23 days. 11.4 is staying there on average 23 days. Only 5% of them go on to prison. The jail is the local level, prison is kind of the larger level. Only 5% go on. So what's happening there? Rikers Island, they did a study of bail. 50% could not post bond of $2,500, which is basically $250 bond was what you got to pass. 50%. So they got to languish in the jail.
Because they can't post bond.
They can't post bond. And think about that for a second. This is, who are these people? And what's going on there?
So it's like an insight from data mining. Like it's this amount of money.
It's not, it gets worse. So, and here's the solution that we're finding. It gets worse. It's a horrific problem. And It is one why we are so focused with data on. Because what has happened is a number of communities have realized there is no good solution of the existing model that works. We have to try something radically new. So one of those is Camden, New Jersey, which has said, hey, 70% of our medical costs come from only 10% of the population. It's incredible because all these people are hitting the safety net. Miami-Dade, Florida, what they did is they said, you know what, this isn't working. We're gonna make an assumption by looking at our health data with our jail data and look at those together, and we say, hey, you know what? This population that's that 70% that you saw that costs, that 10% that costs 70% in Camden, that kind of model, that type of analysis, they're people with mental health issues. So what Miami-Dade did is they trained all the officers, they trained dispatch in mental health intervention. First year alone, $12 million in savings. More importantly, they closed a full jail.
And this came from combining a data set of inmates and mental health data?
We are not talking about, you know, R and Python or pick your favorite language. We are just talking about take two graphs and look at them. This is not like rocket science, right? And so, like, if you think about this at that scale, what would happen if we did that all together? You know, another one on police excessive violence. So we have an incredibly important conversation. It's happening here in San Francisco as well. One of the ones after Ferguson, the president created a task force on 21st century policing, the next generation. A large response of the items, the recommendations, are all data technology. Some of them, body cameras. Oakland, they deployed body cameras. They saw a 50% drop in the first year of complaints. But you know who else got better? The citizens. Like, you're on candid camera.
Surveillance helps.
No, but it's also, the important thing here is that we often forget about data is just there for the citizen. But we have to think about also data for the police officer. The police officer, the disproportionate number, the massive overwhelming are good ones. They're there putting their lives on the line every day. What are we using with data to help them? And so just bear with me for a second, because I think this is really important. We put in a room police chiefs, we put in the room data scientists, technologists, and civic activists.
Fascinating.
So not the group you'd see. So how do you solve this problem?
You brought data scientists to meet with police chiefs.
Police chiefs and the civic activists all in a room, and we closed the door and locked it. These are really old rooms. The locks are big. But we also put presidential cupcakes. They have a seal on them, so like there's nothing more USA than a cupcake. And we have an amazing pastry chef at the White House, by the way. She's really great. So they're really good. But the thing is, like, when you start actually having a conversation about what can you do with the data, they found that they could actually open up the data because they didn't know simple answers. They didn't even know answers. So 16 of the departments decided to open up data. One of those departments started to work with scientists, data scientists out of the University of Chicago, and they started applying very basic machine learning and AI techniques to see features. What are the features that contributed to excessive force? Mm-hmm. The first bucket of features, they're the very strong signal of, oh, you're a bad actor. It's pretty clear. You've got a track record of history of accidents, other stuff. Now, it's signal in the noise, because the disproportionate ones are good. But then the next bucket, did you respond to a domestic violence incident where a child was in the home? Did you respond to a suicide? And here we're in Silicon Valley, people build products. How do you build a product? You put yourself in the shoes of that person. So put yourself in the shoes of that officer. You've just responded to a domestic violence incident. Children are in the home. It is emotionally charged. It's very difficult. Same with suicide. It's messy. There's people. It's highly, highly... Like, no human can go to that type of incident without being changed.
And that's where excessive force happens.
No, where it happens is now you are dispatched to go give a ticket on the street. And that person on the street is now flippant with you. Are we doing what's right by the officer to put them back out on the street without giving them a break?
after they went to a suicide.
Just they went through a highly emotional event. So instead, what they're doing is they're looking at the dispatch system and saying, you know what? Let's think about this in a more intelligent way. Let's build it so that if this kind of incident happens, we give you time off. Domestic violence. If there's only two officers, the probability of fight breaking out is massively high. Let's deploy four officers. Let's try to protect the officers through data. That's the power of data when it is not just used for conversation to bring people together, but for the ability to actually use data to change policies and change the trajectory of a world or an interaction type that we thought has been static for decades, if not a century.
And has there been an effect from those initiatives, from those changes?
So they're starting to do it already. Just a couple weeks ago, we announced a one-year anniversary of the President's Police Data Initiative that got the groups together. We have now 53 different departments that are committed to opening their data. There are 90 data sets available for anyone to use on policedatainitiative.org. And that covers 41 million people.
Now, of course, there were some risks to that. I think last week, there were a data scientist, a technologist, found that in a lot of those data sets that police had released, they hadn't scrubbed the victims' identifying information or their addresses, and basically they were exposing the victims.
Yeah. So let's talk about that, because the day before we had this event at the White House, we actually had another event just before talking with groups that are involved with domestic violence, the police chiefs as well, and really the technologists also saying, how do we ensure the safety of these people? One of the challenges that the police departments have right now that is genuine is it is very hard for them to open up the data. There's no, you know, button that says export as and the data comes out. These data is like
what systems are they even using?
These are legacy old systems, and we have vendors who have built these systems that have built them in a way that lock up the data. And that's a challenge that we're also facing in healthcare, where the data isn't truly interoperable. So it's hard to get the data out. So you need an engineer and a data scientist to figure out how to reverse engineer the schemas and the protocols and all the other technology that makes it happen. And a local department doesn't have the resources to do that. You know, maybe a large city does. Like, we've got LAPD and NYPD are involved in this project. But you go to a department with 20 officers, that's hard. So one is to get that data out. The second is, how do they have that conversation to understand these challenges? Because if they are lucky enough to get it out, they're like, great, we got it out. Let's hope somebody does something. But they don't recognize the implications.
I mean, are there even enough people who know about technology to get it out of those silos and make it public, make it transparent? Are you having to dispatch data scientists to police departments to do things that maybe they don't have the technical capabilities to do that you're asking new things about data?
The thing that I'm most excited by is that a lot of the universities where they're training data scientists are now saying, oh, a great opportunity for our students to learn is to go work with those local communities.
Rather than work in a tech company.
Well, I think it's not necessarily where they go long term, but this is one of the things that I think that we fundamentally miss in our educational system as we're thinking about computer science and data science right now, is what problem do you work on in the classroom? Imagine that if we took the entire energy of the United States educational apparatus, and instead of just mining some social data, they use data on their local communities, whether it's on policing or how to help somebody that is has gone under domestic violence, or where should we put a rec center, or any of the other 200,000 data sets that are existing on data.gov, and they looked at that data, what could we find? Like, what power would that enable for people to do? It's also why we have called for every single data science training program in this country needs to have ethics integrated into the curriculum, not as some bolt-on elective, because just because you can with data doesn't mean you should.
Right. It's fascinating because there's been this explosion of data science programs in the country. There's an explosion of boot camps. And, of course, most of those graduates are going to tech companies now. There's such a need.
And
but you think
pay.
That they could be – and they pay $200,000 a year,
right. Minimum.
So you think – but you think to yourself, those young people would love to train on open – you know, because it's hard to get corporate data. So it seems like it would be great for them to train on government data.
I think it is one of the best places to train. It is also one of the most powerful impacts that you can have on society if you think of it. I practice what I preach here, and this is something that was very important for me. When I was a grad student at University of Maryland, this was a time when not all grad students even had access to the computer lab because there were such constrained resources. And so I had to get my advisor to write me a letter to just give me a key card. And then once I finally got access to that department, those computers, there turned out there may or may not have been a small security loophole in the computer systems. But it allowed me to take over all the computers.
Exploiting.
I feel like someone's going to come on stage and yank me up and say, "We knew it."
Didn't come up in the background
you.
Check.
Didn't come up. All right. But I was able to take over all the computers at night, and so no one would know. So I would come in at like 7 p.m. and then work all night. And what I was doing was I was downloading data from the weather service. And I was ripping through all this data, and that's how we found the signature for the patterns that showed that the weather is not chaotic as we thought. That led us to discover something about different ways to actually improve weather forecasting, which led to something called the Maryland Ensemble-Kalman Filter, which is now used in almost every major weather forecasting system. So when I think about the stuff like I've been fortunate enough to work on,
yeah,
that problem is the problem that touches every day billions of people, nearly, you know, whether you want to call it the 6.5 billion people that live on this planet, call it fine, call it 4 billion or whatever that have access to it. That ability is what something that everybody has the power of. And don't just take that as an example. We have data that has been just done by Dr. Crane and Dr. Black, Angus Black, which just is this year's recipient of the Nobel Prize in Economics. They were taking data and they're able to show that how we're having this incredible problem in the people in their 30s and 40s around suicide, opioid addiction, all sorts of unique challenges and how that is impacting society and looking at that. We have Raj Chetty who's able to take a large data set at the IRS and through that is able to see that a child moving from if you take that child and move a child from high poverty to low poverty in their early teens, just pick them up and move them, you will see as much as 40% lift in their median income just by moving them. That's like that analysis is something that could never be done before. And the ability for that analysis to be discovered and shared to then change the way we have policy, that's revolutionary.
Do you think that there's a difference? I mean, let me ask this. What is the difference between presenting insights that come from data mining to a CEO and presenting insights that come from data mining to a president?
One has a lot more guards. there's actually not a tremendous amount of difference but the precision of asking the richer questions about what does it mean for the broader broader population is where you think about it. For your constituents as a company, you know who they are. For the country, you have every walk of life, and you have to ask who is benefiting, who is harmed, how do we think about the secondary and tertiary impacts of a decision?
Well, it's also like you can't release, like, you know, when you're LinkedIn and you release the people you may know button, you could see the effects immediately on LinkedIn of people clicking on people they knew, and that created a network effect. Can you do the same in government?
What we do and what the framework we're thinking about now is how do we get the equivalent form of agility? And now, I don't want to just say we're just going to slap a button up on the page, but let me give you a kind of example of this, is the Department of Education, working with the U.S. Digital Service, all these kind of new tech people that are from within the government and come into the government, they were able to say, there's incredible data at the Department of Education. How do we unlock it? Because how do you make a college choice right now? You talk to your neighbor, you talk to a friend, you go pull this magazine off the rack at the supermarket, and you try to make a gut call. But there isn't data really backing that up. Department of Education has that data. So what they did is they built a whole interface, the college scorecard.
Yeah.
And if you just do a search on college scorecard, you'll find it. But they also built API saying, great, you don't like the way we built it? No problem. Why don't you take that data and integrate it yourself into the way you want to do it? And then now it becomes a model in which we are all building collectively.
And I love that. I mean, I thought to myself when I saw that come out, like, if when I went to college, what I wanted to be able, that was you could see the cost of the degree. So you could see how much your degree cost and what you'd expect to earn from that degree.
That's right.
And I thought, you know, I'd want to know that. It might not have affected my decision to go to college, but I would have wanted to know that.
That's right. Well, think about some of these other degree programs where there are a lot of really interesting conversations about choice of major and other things. The other one, which I think is becoming really important for us to provide transparency on, is not only the choices, but the questions around diversity, questions around the broad set of opportunities that that are out there for the nation and that you can actually actively participate in. I mean, who would have thought that being a math major offered so much curriculum or so much choice in life? The same way I think is incredibly true with the idea of liberal arts. And people, as they start to look through this data, are going to start to realize, like, hey, liberal arts is actually really incredible background and a phenomenal choice to train.
And have you been able to talk to students who looked at that scorecard and made decisions for their lives using that data?
I have not.
Like, have you seen how the product works, unleashed in the world?
Oh, yeah. So that one, I haven't spent as much time directly with the people who are looking at that, because that has been the Department of Education. The part that has been most powerful for me and where I see the most immediate impacts actually has been in the healthcare space. Mm-hmm. And as we're working and thinking about healthcare, and that's where I've personally spent most of my energy of what does it mean for a patient that's experiencing things and how do we work through the challenges that they face, whether it's on cancer, and maybe we can talk a little bit about the President's Precision Medicine Initiative as well.
Yeah, I'd love to discuss that. Let's jump to policing, though, because I wanted to hear what you thought. So these police departments, the White House has been encouraging them to release data. It's a technical challenge. It's a political will challenge. But then when they do it, they ended up releasing victims' information. So why does that happen, and can that be prevented? Because those are big trade-offs as you go into this new area.
These are the trade-offs. So that's, in fact, one of the reasons why we released this report today. And so the report we released today, well, in fact, let me just say, yesterday what we released is a whole work stream on artificial intelligence and talking about both the opportunities as well as the challenges ahead for artificial intelligence. Remarkable, great opportunities for massive impact on cancer, next generation healthcare. Today's is about the opportunity for big data as well as those challenges writ large. And we kind of walk through four cases in there. One is about educational, basically admissions. Another one is about employment. Another one is about credit lending. And one is about policing.
Right, and each of these, there's great opportunities for data mining, and there's big risks.
And the challenges.
Discrimination.
And in that, one of the things that we have to get everyone to understand is both how do we put the full foot of go, 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 do open up for the opportunity, and make it safe that we're thinking about the broad implications of this. That's why we had that event at the White House on specifically how do you release data and getting people to come up with plans, guidance, almost like a checklist on how to think about it, because they don't know how to release it. People don't even know, like, oh, I didn't know you could do that with the data.
Yeah.
Getting that collectively, that's where we're focused on, is about that. And one of the things I'm most excited about are all the groups that are in the private sector who are now coming forward, whether it's academia or other things, public institutions, who are coming and saying, you know what, we're going to help work on that problem to allow this to happen more easily.
Well, it's interesting because you are the chief data scientist, but in a way you're like the chief data strategist, because you're really trying to guide the country into thinking about how to use data. Or you're not really sitting there with like a machine learning dashboard, like picking out insights here and saying, President Obama, we should be reducing the
That's
number
right.
of people.
I have found in the data. Now, what I get to do is there's two components. The policing problem that we're talking about is primarily at the local level. And as the Constitution and the Founding Fathers really stipulated there's a separation of powers, and these are local problems. And so what we help to do is we say, here's a group that is doing this well. Here's another group that's doing it differently. Let's get you to all share and get everyone to see a path forward.
And a pattern.
And a pattern, and an opportunity way to do this. At the federal level, one of the things that I really look and I'm actively engaged on is how do we think about the policies, the rules, the different nuances that either hinder data being utilized, and utilized could be one agency to another. It could be by public citizens. How do we release it for transparency? How do we unleash it for other people to innovate? But it is also, how do we make sure that those rules and all those other policies are ensuring protection of people?
Right.
And how do we do it safely? And this is why responsibly is so important in the mission statement.
And we talked a little bit about the Precision Medicine Initiative. I'm not sure how much people know about it, but it's quite fascinating because it's millions of people around the country that you're trying to get to contribute their personal health data, their genome, their Fitbit data, their walking data, and saying, can we as a government come up with some, take this big, these massive sets of unstructured data, synthesize them together, and come up with patterns and cohorts that could cure cancer or solve major medical and healthcare problems?
You nailed
it. I mean, I think it's, but so, okay. Well, first of all, where are you with that? And how can you get people mm-hmm. to start contributing data, and where do you find the insights?
Right. So I think one of the most important things to first ask is why do this? Like, what's behind this? We've seen a revolution happen in decoding the genome and figuring out all this information. Yet when you and I go into the hospital or we go into a pharmacy, no one asks, is your genetic information on file? So the drug that you might take, that I might take, they're not tuned for us genetically. Now, in some cases, they're starting to be. There are cases where it's happening. But it's not happening for every single person. So how do we push the entire healthcare ecosystem into the genomic age? And how do we do it so that everyone benefits? And that is the idea of the Precision Medicine Initiative, is to really enable tailored treatments for every single American. Part of that recognition is that of healthcare data, and it is so fragmented within silos of whether it's your physician or a hospital, insurance provider, all these different things, the answers are probably already out there. We just haven't put the data together to ask. The signature for Vioxx, remember Vioxx, the anti-inflammatory drug? The signature, when you look at it afterwards, the signature was already there. Signature was already there, but nobody was looking. These are super obvious questions
David
now
Madigan
in data science.
David Madigan at Columbia.
Pardon?
Right, wasn't that the research? David Madigan
until,
at Columbia.
Until they did the research.
Yeah.
Right? And that's the part that we have to enable for everybody. So what we're doing here is we're saying, how do we do that? Now, doing this ensuring privacy. So we have released the privacy and trust principles for any type of precision medicine type project going forward that anybody in the United States should use. We have released the draft version for the cybersecurity principles. And as a result, out of that, what we have, we are now in the final process of finalizing that, and we'll get that out, what the final version of it is. But making sure the foundations on which this large-scale project, this can be built up.
But how do you get people in business to listen to these principles?
Well, White House cupcakes.
Of course, besides the cupcakes.
Well, we had a precision medicine summit about 6 weeks ago at the White House. And there were 40 massive commitments made by the private and public sectors to do things. The healthcare vendors have committed to doing what's called Sync for Science, which is a pilot that allows you to take your data out of one of their systems from a provider and donate it to research. Another one is that the big data companies here in Silicon Valley, Cloudera and Hortonworks, what they have done is they've said, you know, why is it that bioinformatics people aren't using ubiquitously all these great new technologies that we have? And so they're committed to train a massive number of researchers in the
Hadoop.
Latest big data technologies, Hadoop and other things. And what we're doing there is we're creating the Venn diagram overlap of these two spaces and increasing cross-fertilization so that new techniques can happen faster. We think of it as there's a few things that the White House is uniquely suited to do. We can take some idea and we can accelerate it. We can act as a catalyst for ideas that are just waiting to happen. And then we use convening as a mechanism for those to happen, and then we see what are the other problems in that and then start working to alleviate those.
So convening, so you go to TechCrunch Disrupt and you talk
about... No, we bring them to us because remember, we got the White House cupcakes.
It's hard to ship.
No, we bring people to the White House and we have those meetings, whether they're small, but in some cases like the AI meetings, those will be hosted around the country because we don't want to make it feel like everyone just has to come to the White House. We need to make sure that everybody can participate in this model.
And you think startups out here, AI startups, will want to go to that?
Oh, I know they do because we've gotten the emails from them. But I think one of the things that's important, like in the AI one, is that everyone recognizes that there's really important questions to ask. And take, for example, the Department of Transportation. Secretary Fox has done an outstanding job of already engaging on the questions of self-driving cars and how do we think about this. What we need to do is ask that similar level of depth of question across all the different areas, what AI may touch. And we're not claiming that we know all the answers in the White House, not at all. What we are claiming is across an amazing country that we have, somebody in this country does have the answer to one of the parts of the puzzle. And that if we start putting all those pieces of puzzle together, we'll get the best answer for our kids and our kids' kids.
So you think Silicon Valley right now really wants to have this dialogue with Washington about AI? I mean, I'm skeptical and I'm pushing you because it's just not what we hear from, you know, what I hear from interviewing companies. You know, if they butt right up against regulation, then they'll pay attention to it. But they're not as interested in having a public dialogue. They're interested in building something cool and seeing where the chips fall.
Right, and especially a company that is trying to decide if they're here tomorrow. When, you know, do you spend time talking to a guy in a suit or do you end up for like writing a line of code to ensure that your company exists tomorrow? The part there that we found that is really engaging is these companies and what they are doing is they want to share what type of problem they're trying to solve to ensure that we understand that that's a problem space and they have a thesis for how the world should look. And sharing that is something that happens very regularly between the government and that. And that happens because, you know, the government people come out here, whether it's myself or, you know, the Secretary of Defense or somebody else. Everyone's coming out here talking to them. But also people are regularly coming back and forth. And, you know, like in the healthcare space, just as an example, we had a young entrepreneur, Noga, who's a founder, a CEO of Picnic Health, and she's came out to talk to us about the challenges that are faced in healthcare interoperability and what does it need look like for a startup to enable this for patients and patients' care. And so hearing those challenges allows us a different richness to think about the problems from their perspective and keep them in mind.
And then when you go to set regulations, like do things that she says make it into the way that Washington sets rules. By the way,
Absolutely.
We're going to go to Q&A in 5 minutes. So if folks have questions, just start thinking about your questions. And then you can line up, and we'll do those in a few minutes. Mm-hmm.
So yes, the answer is yes. Now, there's an important process that is here, and they'll tell you about a process where we definitely need massive improvement, because your point is really well taken. The first is when rules, the idea of there's laws and there's rules. When a rule comes out, everyone's allowed to comment on it. Everyone should comment on it. There was a big rule set that came out around healthcare and the way we think about healthcare, something called meaningful use. But not a single Silicon Valley company commented. Zero.
Despite all your evangelism in Silicon Valley.
Now, why is that? They all have a stake in this rule. They have a massive stake in this rule that could determine the trajectory of the success of their companies. So why not?
Yeah.
Well, no one wants to spend their Saturday reading through hundreds of pages of legalese and trying to figure out what should you comment on. And so we have to do a model where we're having an engagement that allows people to very easily provide perspective in a scalable way. And we have to figure that out. And we're trying different models to think about that. But that is where we have to start meeting a different level of citizen engagement.
I want to ask a question about police body cameras, because you've done so much on policing this year. That seems like a huge big data problem. You have massive amounts of digital video data that police departments are going to have to upload and mine, and maybe even the federal government's going to mine it for patterns. What are the challenges there? Are you seeing that as a big challenge or problem?
So the first part is this data is local. So the federal government actually
won't have access to it.
Doesn't have access to it unless it's a national security issue. These are local jurisdiction things. Oakland produces 8 terabytes of data a month. It's not searchable. It's not easy there. City of LA will have 6,000 body cameras deployed by the end of this year. Not searchable. Not easy yet. Think about it also from a body camera. You know, there's a question of is default on, default off, these type of things. Yet, you know, you can design a bracelet here in Silicon Valley that is going to measure how many steps you walk and can tell the difference if you're cycling on a stationary bike or, you know, a fixie or, you know, a 10-speed bike. You know, they can do all this incredible stuff, detect if you're sleeping, how you're sleeping. But we can't make a body camera that automatically turns on at certain times. Intervals if you're starting to run or chase something or there's a certain thing. So how do we bring that form of technology innovation to this problem? What does it mean when we can have a video that is truly searchable because, you know, it's a funny video and we're really good at figuring out search there, but we're not figuring out how to do search here? How do we make sure that a child who is in that body camera in footage, but how do we make sure that they're redacted? How do we make sure that we're not exposing their imagery or providing, you know, any sort of information about them when they shouldn't be? They're just a bystander. Those are the kind of questions that are ripe for technologists. Those are questions that are ripe for artificial intelligence type of how do you search, how do you find type things. And they are phenomenal projects for anybody that is interested in basic science. These are computer vision problems.
Yeah, I mean, more and more issues of public policy are becoming issues of technology.
That's right. That is what the president has recognized. That you've crystallized that part so eloquently is the whole government apparatus. If we ask what is our force multiplier to help solve tomorrow's problems, we have this incredible layer of innovation of technology and data. We just have to figure out how to use that to our advantage as a country and bring that in and mix it and meld it with the traditional policy process that has existed since the founding of the nation.
So now we're going to jump to some questions. Mm-hmm. As a reminder, I've been asked to request that people do not make speeches but ask questions. So keep it short if you can. And I see a question right here. Oh, wait, there's mics coming around. Okay. There's mics coming around. Thanks. This guy has a question right up here. This guy has a question,
DJ,
too.
Thanks for coming. Mm-hmm. Carlo, Informed President. Thanks for coming tonight. Actually, you have two questions. I'm not supposed to. First question.
It's your house.
First question, are you wearing Darth Vader socks?
May the Force be with you.
Cool. Second real question, actually not as real as the last one. You know, I have a startup that's trying to fix the student debt crisis for low-income students.
Can you speak up?
I have a startup that's trying to fix the student debt crisis for low-income students. How would you fix that with data? How would you go about that problem?
I'd get a data scientist.
I have one right here.
You know, this is a really interesting one because every person's experience through college, through payments, through these things, is in what we call an A-B test. You know, the most simple form of an A-B test is the button green or is the button red and which one works better. Each of us is an A-B experiment in life. Every city is an A-B experiment of policies and choices and demographics. And if you're able to bring sufficient data together, you're going to be able to do what we call scout and scale, which is to scout for some ideas, try them out across different cohorts or populations, and figure out then what you can scale. The way we typically say this is prototype for 1x, build for 10x, engineer for 100x. It's the same model we're using in cancer. It's the same model we're using in policing. It's the same model, I think, that has served me particularly well as we've been trying to figure out how do you build a company. And it allows you to really ask yourself what things are in the prototype phase, what things are in the scale phase, and how are we using data every day to get smarter, to get an inside lane, to build a product that is so desperately and importantly needed as the one you're talking about.
We have a question from Dara in the back.
I'm just going to look broadly because I can't.
We can't see anybody beyond the second row.
I'm in fifth grade. Can students access government data?
Wow. For a fifth grader, I want to take a quick second. So, Dara, you're asking, there is a really important narrative that's going on in this country. And the narrative is, are we a great country or a nation or not? And I just want you to think about a second of the question Dara asked and the sophistication that's behind it. 2 weeks ago, we had the White House Science Fair. We had a young lady who was 17 years old, and she's working on renal failure. Renal failure costs us $30 billion a year as a society, not to mention how many loved ones are lost. She has some of the most cutting-edge advanced ideas in renal failure. She's working out of Kentucky in Louisville, doing amazing stuff. And we need more people like that. And so when we think about this narrative, if anybody ever doubts the power or how awesome and amazing this country is, you go hang out with some of these kids, and you will see how it is. So Dara, where's Dara? Stand up, Dara. Awesome. So kudos for you, and awesome that you're asking this. So Dara, one of the things to do, go to data.gov, and you will find more than almost up to just about to cross 200,000 open data sets. But you also can go to your local city. San Jose has an open data program. San Francisco has an open data program. I think Oakland is about to release or already has. But it's amazing what data sets are there. If you go to some of those open data portals, you can start playing with it. We had one of these open data hackathons in New Orleans with the superintendent of police. It's like a police chief. And there's a great image we have of the police chief, and he's hunched over the keyboard, and there's like a 13-year-old African-American girl pointing out how, like, which button to press. She is showing him how to write his first line of code. And the code that he's writing is pulling data about his own police department. And you see who's in power in that conversation. Oh. She's in charge. And she is owning it. And that is that power, is when we change the nature of the dialogue of who is innovating and who is empowered through the use of data, that's when we unleash the power of data. That's when we create this virtuous cycle of transparency and people able to use the data and unleash it in remarkable ways. So please go out and start playing with that data, and I think you will find remarkable, great things to start playing with.
All right, our next question is from the right over here, stage right, and it's from Morris.
Hi, DJ. Quick question for you. When you're talking about the precision medicine initiative, one of the things that's going to emerge out of all of this genomic data, I suppose, is the issue of genomic privacy, and especially when we start looking at insurers denying people coverage for example, certain genes which are expressed differentially in a population. Mm-hmm. What is the government's approach to stopping the insurance companies from having perverse incentives to decline people coverage? Mm-hmm.
One of the things that people don't realize of how thoughtful this president has been about this is the first building block for this revolution of being able to push the entire society forward in the idea of the next wave of medicine starts with the Affordable Care Act. Because having the greatest care system in the world doesn't matter if not everybody has access to it. So it starts with that. One of the seminal tenets of the Affordable Care Act is that there's no pre-existing conditions. Once you get to the genomic level, all of us have a pre-existing condition. That's called being human. So you have to get that out of the way. So that's why that's not there. The second part of this, of pushing this forward, is then these investments of the brain initiative, which is figuring out how to map and think about the brain, the precision medicine, the cancer initiative. Through that process, one of the things that has been really focused on is the different set of rules, whether it's GINA and all these other types, of thinking about all of those aspects and the privacy implications. Because if I donate my data, my brother donates his data, you know, my sister donates her data, have we given up data for all our kids? And what are the implications of that? That is being very, very carefully thought through, as well as something that's called the common rule, which talks about what is the institutional review board and all the implications of the institutional rule board with being able to do large-scale data mining and all the other things like you talked about of ensuring this is being done in a responsible way. And so stay tuned for some of the other things that we'll be doing, including HIPAA clarifications and other aspects of this space that I can't discuss just yet because it's in the process. But we're very aggressively working on exactly ensuring that the long-term safety of this will be taken care of.
We have a question from Melody in the center.
Thank you. Such an exciting talk tonight and such an interesting topic. So my question is about some of the, I guess, the popular social media platforms or web search engines like Google. So Google, Facebook, things like that. Does the government troll that for information? And if yes, is that with the cooperation of a company like a Google or a Facebook?
So the way we troll Twitter most often is we just post pictures of the president being awesome with kids. and so anybody wants to look at the hashtag Obama with kids. But the more important one there, I think what you're asking is, are we really mining that information and aggressively just kind of searching it and those type things? You know, the focus that I've been involved in, and I can't really talk about the national security things because I've been mostly focused on how do we use data predominantly for domestic issues, in particular healthcare and policing and these avenues that we talked about. But the one that is there are really important rules that are in place about this and making sure what data you can look at and what data you can't look at. The other one that I think is really important is asking the question of who else can look at that data. So if we're talking about, in the case of a college admissions, should they really be allowed to look at your Facebook profile? And all should they be allowed to ask you for your credentials to look at the information that is not public? We firmly believe that is not the case. There's other information as the world is rapidly changing, which is how should we think about that data, what is open, what is that data could be used for, credit lending, other type things. And so one of the things that we're really very interested in, and that's why we released this report today, is asking that question to the broad set of American public to start asking what is acceptable and what isn't socially about these type of problems and how are we going to advance forward on these important issues. And it's a dialogue that I think is changing very rapidly with the use of social media and other information.
DJ, do you think that Twitter data will be used to inform the president to make public policy decisions anytime soon?
Well, you know the way it is used.
Like there's a hotspot, there's a crisis hotspot, now we're going to send troops or...
We're definitely not going to put... those that commit to a duty for them in the armed forces to any situation on a whim. And it's a very, very thoughtful decision because it's one that we take massively seriously. Sure. The one, of course, that is there is we use those social media to understand situations in a unique way. There's a large regions of certain parts of the world where information is walled off, and being able to provide interaction with those populations, be able to understand what's happening. These services are phenomenal in engaging community in really unique ways. But let me tell you also about one that we often forget about is people write letters. You know, we have every night, there's thousands of letters that come to the White House, to the president every day. The president gets 10 letters every night. And we are very fortunate that we get access to the same 10 letters. And there is something incredibly awesome about reading those 10 letters. Some are externally positive, some are very negative, some are cries for help. They're amazing. Today, the president was in Flint because an 8-year-old girl wrote to him about, she's called Little Miss Flint, and she talked about how she's an activist to ensure that she has safe water. And the president just went out to meet her because of the letter. I got to call some of the people who wrote in around precision medicine and cancer and the challenges that they face. There's one woman that wrote in. She's a phenomenal woman, and she has a small son. She wrote in because she wanted to emphasize that given her the disease that she has, she is in a fight for her life, and the fight for her life is determined by the speed at which we are able to advance science. If we do not move fast enough, she will die. That's a letter I keep above my desk, because anytime somebody asks, how do you keep your focus, how do you keep your eye on the ball of going after the things, I have that letter. I have a picture of her, her husband, and her son. And that is how we stay singularly focused on these type of problems and focused on what does it mean to actually do this for a human, a person, rather than just some notion of a policy or a headline.
We have our next question from Jeff in the very back.
This is the last question. One more after this, sorry.
What are they going to do, kick
us
off
stage? Sorry, I'm getting a prompt.
This has to do with electronic health record interoperability, which is a tremendous problem. And I'm a general practice physician. We're very disorganized in healthcare. Look at our national budget. And interoperability, so we can get the information between the systems, is critical, even for just moving a practice from one EHR to another, where you're basically a captive. And you may move your patients, but not your accounts receivable. Are there any plans to revoke meaningful use certification for electronic health records that don't meet the interoperability requirements?
Mm-hmm. So the question that is really being asked here around interoperability is a question of standards, and are we going to be able to penalize people for who are not playing fair or doing what they should to enable what this looks like. So I can't comment on the specifics of what a particular agency is doing or going to do around things that are in what are called an active rulemaking. What I can tell you is this is an issue that is absolutely front and center. And the one I would encourage people to take a look at is don't just trust my words, trust the president's words. And there's a video that we posted around, if you do a search for Precision Medicine Initiative video president, or just do a search on your favorite video search engine, you'll find it. And in there, what the president talks about is why is interoperability have to happen and what does it need to look like and why do we need to take place? One of the things that we're very pleased to see is that a number of the vendors have really stepped forward with this commitment to engage in this pilot called Sync for Science that allows you to take your data out and plug it into a research or another system. What you're addressing is that this is not happening fast enough to benefit all of us, and that is absolutely a true statement. And one of the things that we have to have is we have to have a fundamental belief system that we have with all of our data that at the push of a button, I should have my data. It's your data. And that data should be able to move it as you see fit. The value proposition, and Harvard Business Review has been doing some of the work on this, is the best value proposition, as we know all so well here in Silicon Valley, is to open up the system and compete on the value proposition of great services. And when you provide that services, the interoperability actually moves faster, and the system and ecosystem move better, and we have to enable that to happen. We're starting to see evidence of it, and you will see a lot more coming on this over near time. And for anybody that actually doubts the question of, in this time of the administration, are we this committed or are we just done? The president hands us a card when we come in. You know what that card says? Really remarkable things happen in the fourth quarter. Anybody watch a Warriors game? So right. We are 100% aggressively focused, going all out to do every single thing we can to sprint across the finish line on these critical issues that you're calling out.
So we'll have one last question. I think this gentleman here has had one.
All right. One sec.
Hi, DJ Kalpesh. Great, wonderful presentation. You're going back to DC. What can we do with TSA and during summer with all these long lines and improve the national productivity with data? Government has all of our data. Why do we have to have pre-TSA and pay money? And mm-hmm. You know?
I stand in line with you. There's no preferential treatment. You know, one of the things that I think you're highlighting really importantly is how do we use data to create efficiencies in the system? You know, we have a really important model that's out there, and we have to figure out how to use that data to make the smartest decisions. And in that case, you have to have 0% error rate. There can be no room for error. And so how do you do that, and how do you try that and do that? And one of the things that we're seeing across the federal government, I can't comment specifically on the TSA one, because I'm not trying to dodge, because I just don't know what they're doing, because I haven't spent time on this problem, other than standing in line with you. I spent a lot of time in that line. But the specific part there is that everyone is asking, how can we do smarter and better decisions in that case? One of the ones that I think has been really impressive by the Department of Homeland Security is on the immigration process. And when I think immigration process, I think a lot of people are thinking about, you know, how do we figure out who's good, who's bad? But it's actually that a lot of people in this country have the right to be a citizen, but they don't know it. And the forms and processes that they go through, the only way to do it is to pay somebody a lot of money that they shouldn't have to. Because the service that they should provide, it should be easy, like you do with a consumer experience. Like you go to a site and says, here's what it should look like. Have you answered this question? Do this. And you go through this flow and you have your documentation and you're allowed to do what by law and by constitutional authority is right. So the U.S. Digital Service, that team of technologists from the government and those that have come in to do a tour of duty to work on these problems collectively, they took on this challenge. One of the women who led it, she comes from an immigrant family that came up from Cuba because she feels so personally important about it. They use this most modern techniques of user-centered design, the most advanced things that we're all used to here in Silicon Valley of agile development, all those type of things. And they've got a phenomenal user experience. And through that case, an immigrant family that starts going through that system has a chance to go through there, not pay anything, but also be a part of the society that many of us that came here as immigrants have equal right to. And that is that part of what happens when those of us in Silicon Valley, those that are already in the federal government who are doing amazing work, come together, not doing it separately, but come together to work on a problem. And when we come together and work on that problem, we get to unleash the full force of the United States of America on a problem to solve it for the entire country. And when that happens, that is the power when you see lives change. And that is the part that, if I have one thing to tell all of you, it's out there, is think about how to get engaged on these type of problems. Because all of you have a skill set. All of you have an idea. All of you have wisdom and experience. And if you bring that to the federal government, if you bring it to your local government, if you share on it on June 4th, the National Day of Civic Hacking, where everyone is coming together to work on these kind of problems, if you get engaged, you will see the power of an individual able to change the trajectory of this nation by working on these problems together.
Thank you so much, CJ. Thank you. So I've been told it's an informed tradition to ask all of our speakers the following question. DJ Patel, what is your 60-second idea to change the world?
So the quick version is we live in an amazing society. It has a fabric of society. Occasionally there's kinks, there are bumps in the society, problems happen. We tell stories about it. We write about it. We talk about it. And then we fix it through policy, through legislation, through services. And that fabric of society becomes smooth, like a sidewalk that has a bump. What happens when that fabric of society becomes increasingly digital? What happens when you go to one system and the database didn't update in time to say that you are actually qualified for something? There's a hurricane. Are you allowed services? A foster child who says can't have access to their immunizations or their records. My idea for all of you is the way we enter into figuring out what does our society look like as it moves to becoming increasingly digital starts with the citizen. It starts of those of you who have an idea of how to have intellectual capacity around technology and bring that to the policy domain to interact. And by interacting together with these local cities like we talked about, being able to work collectively on a problem, we will be ready to not just be fearful of the issues that may happen in a digital fabric society, but enable to use that digital aspect of society to provide better and faster services for every person in this country.
Thank you. Let's give a round of applause for DJ. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I think we're done.
We're done.
We're done. All right. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.